Part 3, Chapter 1, in which the Captain returns. The end is in the beginning, and yet you go on. Samuel Beckett, Endgame. O patient and respected readers, O gods, demons, patricians, and paupers, hear now the call of trumpets that hail your peerless pilgrim of the sea. Shutter your shops and close your houses, and follow the shuffling of feet on the road to the agora. Come, live again the passions and pains of your single and copied lives. See, there, the costume cut, the curtain ascending, the mirror of a man strides the stage. It was 3 minutes past 9 in the evening when Melanie Edwards pulled into the basement garage of her apartment in Leucadia, California. Her visitor had been pensive and quiet during the ride from the airport, and when they were inside her apartment, he was drawn to a sliding glass door that led to a balcony overlooking the Pacific. The view from the 14th floor was magnificent, but Harvey longed to be near the waves. "I've got virtual reality," said Melanie, turning on her computer. Harvey pressed his face against the glass and continued to stare into the night. "It's too salty and sticky out there," Melanie continued, "but I can get the balcony on TV." Her guest made no response, and Melanie was forced to open the door. A bird fluttered off the rail when they stepped outside, and Harvey watched it disappear into the blackness over the water. "Ah," he sighed, "to be as a bird." When Melanie did not react to this oft-repeated quotation, our hero realized she had not read parts 1 and 2 of his novel. He was immediately disheartened, for that meant she would not understand a single thing in parts 3 and 4. Only Mahogany could truly understand, and he was thousands of miles away. They sat on the balcony and talked, but Melanie was not as interesting as her brother, and she quickly grew tired of their shared soliloquy and showed the captain to his room. However, as soon as she left him, Aipnia, the goddess of jet lag and insomnia, led Harvey out of the apartment and down to the lobby. When he stepped from the elevator, Harvey was struck with a feeling of déjà vu. Perhaps Mahogany had told him about the place, or maybe the apartments were not far from his old sanitarium. Moving toward the large picture window, he paused to admire the view. The waves looked familiar, and the horizon, and just then the room burst into flames. Then it became whole again. Then it was a room in a sanitarium. Then it was in flames again. Harvey grabbed his head as the flashbacks continued. The narrator breaks in. "What? What is this? A rush of memories spinning through the mind of a captain? Or a captain spinning through a rush of memories? Could it be these present apartments were built on the site of the destroyed sanitarium? The lobby constructed in the space of our hero's lost room, filled with the infinite forms of himself described during his years in captivity? Oh, poor and protean captain, who and what will you become, merging and separating shapes, bouncing from time to time to time?" Footnote. The reader who has read parts 1 and 2 will remember that the exact imitation of any shape in the history of time takes the imitator back to the time of the original holder of that shape. In this case, Harvey has stepped into his own form of 34 years earlier and has been transported to the year 1979. The speed with which Harvey slipped from self to self made him dizzy, and he staggered out the door. Dazed and disoriented, he strayed from the sanitarium and collapsed in a grove of eucalyptus. The sand was warm to the touch, and he concentrated on its feel until his head ceased to spin. Then he lay down and drifted off to sleep. The coast near Leucadia had not yet been deforested in 1979, and Harvey awoke the next morning to a chorus of birds. He was pleased. These were not the foreign birds of so many places abroad, but familiar ones, singing old songs he could anticipate and share. When he sat up and stretched his shoulders, he was surprised at how strong and flexible he felt. He seemed like a man half his age. "It must have been the apartment's sanitarium," he thought. "I must be in myself of years before." Filled with newfound vigor, he rushed to the sea. To his dismay, he found the beach strewn with debris. It was the wreckage of a ship that had been lost the night before, and he picked up a broken board and caressed it with his hands. "O ancient mother," he said, "what splinters are these that some distant storm, careering with swift steps, has spread upon the shore? What shipwreck here? What sunken star? What lost conqueror have you buried in your bosom? Did he know the inebriation of the daring departure, the brash journey and the triumphant return? Was he my brother, just as myself, seeking the embrace of a friend? Where is he now among these bits and pieces of a dream? Where is his spirit that challenged the dawn, his fearless heart and voice louder than the storm?" But the ancient mother replied not, and Harvey started down the beach. He couldn't help but see his own life in the rags and bottles and boards, and he was ashamed to consider himself, his insignificant self, in the face of the truly great. He was mortified that he had even opened his mouth at all, blackening the pages of parts 1 and 2 with his self-consumed adventures. He realized that amid all that blab he had not once had the least idea of who or what he was, and that beneath all his contrived and chaotic pages the real Harvey stood as yet untouched, mocking him with mock congratulatory bows, pointing in silence to his pages and then to his emptiness within. He recognized that he had never understood a thing, not a single object, and that no man ever could. As the waves called to him with their savage sound, he was gripped with the tedium of being so many men and women who grieve, rejoice, and melodiously expire. How much longer could he deceive himself about the significance of life, when he was only repeating the lives of others? For him, the journey was finished, and he had no wish to begin anew. He did not care if his end meant the end of all things, for it was pitiful to cling to existence, eking out its last vain dregs. "There he is," cried a nurse from the sanitarium, "down by the water." The captain looked up and saw a group of orderlies running toward him, and for a moment he considered going back to his room. Then he turned and swam to sea. "What's that?" said Hesiod, standing and stretching in the sun. "It looks like sea kelp," said Anaximenes. "No, it moved," said Thales. "I think it's alive." "It is alive," shouted Prometheus, rising to his feet. As the slimy green mass began to move, the first thing to emerge from its shapelessness was a pair of extremities that resembled arms, then another pair that resembled legs. Clawing its way up the shore, two hands emerged from the seaweed webbing, then 2 feet and a head. Slowly and painfully, The beast raised itself off the sand and began to move on all fours. And when it sat back on its haunches, its underbelly flashed in the sun. Finally, with a show of Herculean strength, it rose to stand on its legs, and the kelp fell away to reveal the body, limbs, and face of a man. "Arrgh!" growled the salty mammal. When the figure collapsed again, the young men recoiled, then rushed to his aid. Helping him to his feet, they girded him in a towel and started up the shore. And as he came to his senses, the captain saw his form casting a long black shadow, and he knew he was alive.